the latest research into the causes and treatment of migraines. Chances are someone you know has experienced a migraine. Millions of Americans have firsthand knowledge of the pain and other sensory side effects of these headaches and have tried to seek relief from them. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll talk with three experts about the latest research into the causes of migraines and explore some of the triggers that can spark an event. We'll also look at some of the treatment options, including medication and even surgery. Migraines can be debilitating for some people, but there is some research that suggests these headaches actually are beneficial and are the body's way of protecting and repairing itself from toxins in the brain. And as always, we want to hear from you. Tell us about your experiences with migraines and what works to alleviate your discomfort. The causes and treatment of migraine headaches, today on Main Calling. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Bangor, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. You may have experienced the throbbing pain or flashes of light that come with the onset of a migraine. These severe headaches affect more than 30 million Americans, from children to older adults. And as any migraine sufferer knows, it can be difficult to get relief from them. Today we'll learn more about the symptoms, causes, and treatments of migraines. I have three experts with me to talk about migraines and to answer your questions. Dr. Jonathan Borkum is a licensed psychologist with 20 years of experience in the treatment of pain and headaches. He's also a faculty associate at the University of Maine. Dr. David Branch is a plastic surgery specialist at Bangor Plastic and Hand Surgery, where he treats migraine patients. And Dr. Daniel Schwartz is a neurologist in Augusta who's affiliated with Maine General. He specializes in headache medicine. And as always, we want to hear from you. Do you get migraine headaches? Have you found some way to prevent or treat them? Or do you just learn to live with them? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Schwartz, we'll start with you with the very basics. What is a migraine headache?
So a migraine headache is basically a severe, moderate to severe rather, headache that is generally associated with nausea, sensitivity to light, and or sensitivity to sound. In general, they last anywhere between 4 and 72 hours. And in about 20% of individuals, there will be an aura before the onset of the headache, usually visual disturbance of some sort.
But there can be different versions for different people. Some may not have an aura. Do these symptoms always come together?
So about 20% of people have aura. The remaining 80% don't have any aura. Most folks will have a prodrome of some sort, either fatigue or muscle tension, before the onset of the headache. There's a fair amount. Usually the pain is throbbing or pulsating in character, and it's usually on one side of the head, although in some folks it'll be on both sides of the head. It can be alternating from one side to the other in a good percentage of individuals.
Dr. Borkum, how do we differentiate, say, a migraine from any of the other, you know, categories of common headaches that we have? It's more than just severity, right? There are things that make a migraine a migraine?
Yes, although severity is certainly a factor, because migraines are generally moderate to severe in intensity. But exactly as Dr. Schwartz said, a migraine is not simply a headache. It's combined with nausea or both light and sound sensitivity. It's worse with routine physical activity. People often avoid physical activity, climbing stairs, moving around. People, if they bend over during a migraine, it kind of increases the pressure in the head and intensifies the pain. That would be unlikely with other types of headache. Mm-hmm. So if it's the type of headache that makes you want to lie down in a dark room and glare at people who walk too hard on the floor, then it's probably a migraine.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the other, there are tension headaches. What are some of the other headaches that we know about?
So the most common headache would be tension-type headache. That lasts anywhere from 30 minutes to several hours and does not have the accompaniments that migraine has. It's usually an inwardly directed pressure pain. It's usually on both sides of the head. It's usually mild to moderate in severity, and it's not generally combined with nausea. Sometimes very mild, you know, people want to, they don't have an appetite sometimes during a tension-type headache. Or it might be just lights that bother them a little, or just sounds that bother them a little, but you don't have the full picture of a migraine.
Yeah. Dr. Branch, what do we know about what causes migraines?
Well, I think that there's been or is an ongoing sort of shift in the paradigm of understanding of headaches since the surgical fields have gotten involved in the last, over the last 20 years. So I think that... you know, our definition of what a migraine is sort of expands upon the current understanding. And I think the traditional understanding is that migraines are propagated from within and that the pathology is within the brain. And that's why, you know, the vast majority of treatments is, have been directed towards systemic medications that are taken by mouth that have to act on the inside of the brain. I think with... you know, the advent of Botox, we've found that intervening under the skin, where it's a little safer than working chemically inside the brain, that we have found that that has diminished the severity and eliminated a number of people's headaches. And it was that serendipitous sort of finding that coincided with the serendipitous finding that those same people who had the frowning muscles removed in a cosmetic procedure, those same patients, without any elicitation from the surgeon, were commenting that their migraine headaches were disappearing or improved. And then that kind of serendipitous, by happenstance, finding kind of led to the investigation that's taken place over the last 20 years that's brought us to, I think, this critical point where the surgical treatment of headaches is bursting its way into the mainstream for people with chronic migraines or people who do not tolerate the medications.
And we'll get back to the surgery part as well a little bit later. But this comes back to you, Dr. Schwartz, because you work with patients using Botox and have firsthand knowledge of I guess this connection of how. Now, the discovery of how that drug helped to prevent migraines in patients. But what first, I want to get to some of the triggers that spark this event. It could be stress, but there could also be dietary triggers. Could you just talk about a few of those?
Sure. So there's a lot of triggers that people have, people have for migraines. They can range from stress to sleep deprivation, skipping meals. Certainly, some people are sensitive to certain odors, perfumes. Some other triggers might include certain foods like MSG or simple carbohydrate-type foods such as spaghetti or pasta. Those are the most common triggers, although they can be quite individual.
I've heard red wine.
Red wine is a very common one, yes.
Nuts, I've also heard. But yeah.
Nuts. Mm-hmm.
Cheese.
Cheese also. It seems like... anything at a cocktail party might trigger. But it's different for each person. Might one person have multiple triggers?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question.
Is migraine on the rise, Dr. Borkum? What are you seeing in your professional experience?
Well, there have been studies around that. If I could speak to the triggers a bit.
Yeah.
Exactly as Dr. Schwartz said, there are a very wide variety of triggers. When they do studies worldwide, though, it's usually just about half a dozen triggers, maybe a little more, that keep turning up with regularity. The top two are psychosocial stress and an impending storm. And then also, exactly as Dr. Schwartz said, dehydration, skipping meals, low blood sugar, certain foods, red wine, dark chocolate. Falling estrogen levels. So women will also often have a migraine or a more severe migraine around the time of their period.
Now, an impending storm, I have to follow up on. Is that a change in bariatric pressure, or do we know what that is?
Well, it coincides with the change in barometric pressure. Whether that is the active ingredient in triggering a migraine is not certain. The closest that we found to an explanation for why inclement weather would bring on a migraine is that the wind picks up before a front moves in. And that picks up very small particles of dust that are an inflammatory stimulus in the lungs and therefore an inflammatory stimulus in the blood vessels and in the body. So that's the best guess about why it's bad weather, but that's not a very well understood field.
If I might add, I have seen patients for years, and many of them come in and their spouse will say he or she is a human barometer. We know when there's going to be a storm because they get a headache. And we also see that that same patient oftentimes will get a severe headache with air travel. So I feel like it is more of a barometric pressure. And those types of signs on patients make us look into the nose. So we're generally looking for an anatomic contact point or a bubble of bone inside the nose that is correlated with that kind of barometric trigger. And addressing that with a septoplasty or turbinate reduction is how we address that anatomic finding. And those patients typically do well after that.
What do we know about why the trigger is a trigger? I mean, what is it that red wine and chocolate and wind have in common in creating this response that becomes a migraine?
Well, I think Dr. Borkum has some theories about free radical generation, and which is a very interesting theory. And no doubt, I'm sure plays some part. Actually, some of our electron microscopy studies of migraine nerves that were compared to non-migraine nerves found that there was an upregulation of some of the free radical scavengers, which would address some of those issues. But I think that in terms of the triggering mechanisms, we think of it more in terms of either being vascular, meaning a blood vessel is up against a nerve, or a muscle, like the frowning muscles or the tension muscles in the back of the neck, or the chewing muscles in the temple around those nerves. So increased tension and pressure on the nerve, vascular, bony. So some nerves are actually encased in a bony canal or have a bony ridge that is creating sort of a dent in the nerve. And then there's other just fibrous bands. So I think that the act of squinting, the act of frowning, the act of clenching your teeth, all of those sorts of things, I think, tend to aggravate those that have a muscular compression.
Yeah, Dr. Borkum, maybe now's a good time to get to your theory, which we have talked about before in a previous news story, about this role that oxidants play and what migraines might actually be beneficial in some way to the body.
Yes, absolutely. So when you look at migraine triggers, whether it's particulate matter in the air or psychosocial stress or certain foods or falling estrogen levels, one thing that they all seem to have in common is that they increase levels of oxidative stress in the brain. They increase oxidant production in the brain. And it's very hard to find any migraine triggers that do not have that effect. Now, increasing oxidant production in the brain is not good for the brain. First, it is a signal that something has gone wrong in the brain, and any number of things going wrong can increase oxidant production. So it's a good signaling mechanism. And oxidants in high concentrations can damage the brain. So it's a good thing for the brain to be able to detect and respond to. And we know that the nerves in the dura mater, the covering over the brain, especially near the blood vessels, right, good place to have sentries stationed in the brain, have detectors in them, an ion channel that will pick up the presence of rising levels of oxidative stress. And when these nerves detect oxidative stress, they inflame the blood vessels. So they produce a nerve-generated or neurogenic inflammation around the blood vessels, which is the cardinal feature of the acute migraine attack. So it looks like migraines are set in motion in part by an increase in oxidative stress in the brain.
Hmm. Let's touch on treatments. And Dr. Schwartz, first medication. What's the sort of, I guess, standard first go-to for migraine medication?
So most folks with migraines will have one or two attacks a month. Studies have shown that about a quarter will have four or more attacks a month. And for those people, we usually talk about starting a preventive medication. And for the acute treatment of a migraine, we talk about acute medications. And any sort of treatment management discussion usually revolves around those two components, prevention and then acute treatment. Now, for acute treatments, we have many different pharmaceutical type options, ranging from non-steroidal anti-inflammatories to more migraine-specific medications.
But there have been recent discoveries about a particular chemical, a link to this chemical that is that directing now where sort of pharmaceuticals are moving.
So this year there's a host of new medications coming out for acute treatment as well as prevention of migraines called the CGRP receptor antagonists. Our understanding of migraine has progressed significantly in the past 20 years, and a lot of the evidence seems to be pointing towards CGRP as well as some other inflammatory proteins that in the genesis of migraine pain. And these new medications that are coming out are directed specifically towards that one molecule.
Are we in the testing on mice phase in this right now? Or?
Oh, no. These are commercially available at this point.
Yeah. I want to get back to a question that we kind of skipped over, but it's about the prevalence of migraines. Are we seeing more in recent years? And if so, do we know why?
Well, this is Dr. Borkum. There certainly has been a very large increase in the prevalence of medically recognized migraines. So when you study, you know, for example, at charts at the Mayo Clinic, and the number of people coming in who have a diagnosis of migraines, that's approximately doubled. When you do population-based studies, even if it's in a remote village in Turkey, the prevalence seems to have doubled since around 1990. Whether that's a true increase is much less certain, because it was after 1990. It was in 1990 or so that Imitrex came out, sumatriptan. So it was the first time that there were really good treatments for migraines. And so people who previously had simply thought of them as a blinding headache or a sick headache or even just part of life, I think started coming and seeing their doctors and saying, hey, you know, I think I have this disorder.
Sure. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. The number is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Efficiency Maine, offering homeowners rebates and financing for insulation and heating systems, efficiencymaine.com, and Faderly Law, dedicated to providing effective counsel on all matters of land use and real estate in Maine. Learn more at FaderlyLawMaine.com.
President Trump already works closely with Mike Pompeo as head of the CIA.
We have half hour, 40 minutes every day. He asks lots of hard questions, as any good intelligence consumer would.
He's engaged.
And he's very engaged and very appreciative of the information that we deliver to him.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Mike Pompeo's confirmation hearing to become Secretary of State this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Planet Money, we hear the backstory on 9 very influential numbers.
We know that eventually the Social Security number would take over our lives, but how exactly did that happen and when did it happen?
And on How I Built This, when Lisa Price couldn't find beauty products for African-American women, she decided to start her own line.
It's an hour of economics and innovation on Planet Money.
And How I Built This from NPR.
Planet Money and How I Built This are back-to-back Saturday morning at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we're talking about migraines, what to do about them. In our Bangor studio with me, David Branch, plastic surgery specialist at Bangor Plastic and Hand Surgery, Daniel Schwartz, neurologist with Maine General, specializing in headache medicine, and Jonathan Borkum, psychologist who treats headaches and as a faculty associate with the University of Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to Raphael in Portland in a moment, but while we're on the subject of treatment, I wanted to get to surgery as promised. Is there a most common surgery for correcting or preventing migraine?
Well, there are four primary sites that we operate on, and then two secondary sites. They're all superficially approached and just beneath the skin. The only site that we approach in a different way is the nose. The most common site is the brow and the temple. The back of the neck, the greater occipital nerves, is a closed third, and then a septoplasty for those people that have rhinogenic migraine that show that barometric trigger. That is the fourth site. There's two others in the back of the neck as well that are less commonly involved, and one in front of the ear. So doing the surgery, there's a couple of different philosophies. One is to do one zone at a time. Unfortunately, a lot of insurance companies they incentivize doctors to approach them one zone at a time. I tend to try to approach more than one. There are some studies that show that if you operate on all four zones at the same time, then you have the highest chance of a complete response, meaning no more headaches. I've had patients liken it unto the game whack-a-mole. My first patient that I operated on, which was 15 years ago, who had been an inpatient at the Faulkner Clinic in Boston for over a month, she had primarily frontal symptoms and very little posterior neck symptoms. And I operated on her brow and her temple, and she came back about a month later complaining of severe pain, but all of her pain was in the back of the neck. All of the pain in the front had disappeared. So we subsequently operated on the back of her neck, and she's now 15 years out from surgery.
And when you say operated on, what specifically did you do in those areas?
So other than the nose, you think about the small little surgeries as little miniature carpal tunnel releases. So we go in and we find a sensory nerve that is the target that we've identified. We dissect that nerve and oftentimes we're removing a small amount of muscle from around the nerve, or we're removing a small blood vessel that may be kind of impacted next to the nerve, or we're removing sometimes small little chips of bone that may be encasing that nerve at its exit point from the skull. We trace the nerve out. We make sure that there's nothing pulsating against it, nothing, you know, hard pressing against it, or nothing muscular contracting against it. And then oftentimes we'll replace that muscle with a little bit of fatty tissue, which is a non-contractile type tissue. So that's kind of the general principle, and it very much harkens back to our carpal tunnel release, where, you know, I've seen patients that have come in and they've been on many medications to treat what sounded to me like garden variety carpal tunnel syndrome, and did the carpal tunnel release, which is about a 15 or 20 minute surgery, and the patient goes pain-free. And migraines is kind of like that, but it's a lot more complicated because these different zones are communicating from within the brain, and certainly there are central triggers with a lot of people.
Okay, let's try the phones. Let's go to Raphael in Portland. Hi, Raphael.
Hey, how you doing? Can you hear
good,
me?
Good, thanks. Go ahead. You're on the air. Yep.
Yeah, I've been a migraine sufferer. I'm 58 now. Since about 1984, I've had 9 adult concussions and have had severe migraines forever. They've had me on a rash of drugs over time, and the one relief I've finally gotten in the last years, getting off all medications, is a device called Acephaly. It's a, if I can pronounce it, a trigeminal nerve stimulator. It's a little electrode you put in the middle of your forehead. You attach this device to it, and it puts an electric pulse into your head, I guess you could say. And I get extreme relief with that. And I've been using it for a number of years. Have you heard about this?
This is Dr. Schwartz. Yes, the Acephaly device came out a few years ago. I've had a lot of luck with it myself. The reason why we think it works, it's a TENS-like unit, if people have heard of TENS units for treatment of pain or musculoskeletal issues. It releases small sort of electrical stimulation-type jolts. It's not very uncomfortable, my understanding is. Definitely, there is a peripheral component to, by that I mean not just in the brain, but the nerves on the outside of the skull, if you will, under the scalp, as a generation site for migraine, pain, or headaches in general. There's no question that there's a significant role for the nerves on the outside of the skull in terms of the onset of these headaches. And the general thinking about the device is that it may deplete the nerve endings of pain-releasing or pain-triggering chemicals.
Could that also, this is Dr. Branch, work on the gating theory, whereby the non-noxious stimulations kind of crowd out the painful signals because there's only a certain number of highways? I mean, that's the theory behind the TENS units for elsewhere. I'm not familiar with its use for migraines.
All right, Raphael, thank you very much. We're going to go to Jason in Bangor. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, so I had really debilitating migraines in my early childhood, probably up until I was about 12, and then they stopped, and then I had a really bad one when I was 18 and so had anything at all. And I'm just wondering, is it common for people to grow out of them, or should I expect more?
So Dr. Bo Billy was a Swedish researcher whose claim to fame was that he studied a group of people who had migraines from childhood for the next 40 years. And what he found is that the most common pattern was that people would go for long periods of time without migraines. They might have a resurgence under periods of unusual stress and then go for long periods without them. But it was an ebbing and flowing course. There was no general tendency among his group for migraines to become more frequent or less frequent over the 40 years.
Yeah, interesting. So, Jason, you may be off the hook for a while, but there are no guarantees. I guess that's my medical opinion. Let's see. We have an email from Ryan who writes, I've been dealing with exertion-induced migraines for 20 years. I've seen all kinds of specialists. I'm paraphrasing there. I get them from running, rock climbing, even shoveling snow or heavy lifting. I've tried Imitrex and Tompyramate with little or no benefit. I'm looking for some new paths to fixing this issue, especially now that I have an 11-month-old baby girl. We're not going to give him medical advice on the radio, but in general, what might be some of your responses to, an exertion-induced migraine? Any ideas? Dr. Schwartz?
Well, exertion as a trigger for headaches is actually part of the criteria for the diagnosis of migraine, so it does sound like we're dealing with migraines. As far as what to do about exertion being a trigger for the migraines, some folks have tried propranolol, which is a beta blocker, before physical activity with some success. Some people have tried taking a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory before physical activity. I've had some luck treating folks with exertional headaches in that respect.
Yeah. Let's go to Shirley in Union. Hi, Shirley. Welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Yes. My question is, my husband had visual migraines for years, good 30, 40 years. And then last year, he was diagnosed with glioblastoma. Is there any connection?
Well, it's a hard one to say here without knowing about the case, but any insight that we could give to Shirley?
Well, there have been studies of brain imaging of people with migraines, and I believe the general finding is that the likelihood of finding something on MRI in somebody who has migraines is the same as the probability of finding something on MRI in somebody who does not have migraines. That migraines, you know, properly diagnosed by a physician, by a neurologist, do not imply that anything else has gone wrong in the brain.
Yeah. Shirley, thank you for calling. From Jody, can you please discuss migraines that present similarly to mini-stroke, TIA, and that are not characterized by an excruciating headache or without any headache at all? Interestingly, I was talking to Dr. Schwartz before we went on air about my personal experience with a couple of painless migraines, which I feared were a stroke and ended up being explained as a painless migraine. So this is a real thing then, Dr. Schwartz.
Absolutely, it's a thing. It's always our first main job as physicians is always to exclude dangerous or bad stuff first. So it's a diagnosis of exclusion. However, it is well known and well documented that people can have motor, meaning weakness, or sensory numbness and tingling, even dizziness or visual disturbance. There's many forms of aura, is what we call it. And it probably has to do with the reason, the pathophysiology or what's going on in the brain with a migraine, which is our current understanding is that it's dysfunctional neuronal networks that are hyperexcitable. So the neurons are firing inappropriately in inappropriate ways. That's our current understanding. And that can manifest physically with all types of symptoms. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Borgham.
So our understanding of migraine aura, which is most often visual, but it can be numbness and tingling that spreads slowly over at least 5 minutes down an arm, for example, or across the face, or a weakness that develops slowly on one side of the body, you know, again, assuming that this has been diagnosed by a physician. Our current understanding is that underlying the aura is a wave of activation that spreads over the cortex, and in its wake is an area of much decreased spontaneous brain activity. And so what causes this wave of spreading cortical activation is a matter of some debate. Mm-hmm. One explanation is that the cortex is overexcitable, and when a certain number of neurons reach critical mass and you have enough excitatory chemicals in the brain, that's enough to trigger this wave. And in that case, if a person is getting a lot of migraine aura, they might want to consider the level of stimulation that they're exposed to, either in the environment or internally. Some people stimulate their brains a great deal through worry or a great deal of thinking. The other explanation for cortical spreading depression is that it is a defensive response by the brain to a threatened interruption in blood supply. So, for example, in animals, if you introduce very small embolisms that will, you know, block a tiny blood vessel for just a half a second and then vanish, that's enough to produce this cortical spreading depression, which makes sense because if you induce cortical spreading depression, so you induce what we think is the equivalent of a migraine aura in an animal and then expose the animal an hour later or even 24 hours later to an actual interruption in blood supply, that animal will be partially protected. So migraine aura does protect the brain against an interruption in blood supply. So if a person is getting a lot of migraine auras, I would encourage them to adopt a heart-friendly diet, not eat a lot of fried food, a lot of fast food, a lot of fatty food, to stay hydrated, and generally do things that are good for the cardiovascular system.
And let's go to Marion here and bring Marion into the program. Hi, Marion calling from Western Maine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have a couple things that have happened to me, and what you've spoken about in the last 5 minutes really makes sense. When I was a little bit younger, I had two or three experiences over the past 20 years where I had sun sensitivity or physical exertion sensitivity, and I sort of got like a kaleidoscope aura in my eyes, and I quickly sat down where I was on the road running, or I was snorkeling in some very sunny water when we had just arrived at a vacation spot around noontime when it was extremely bright, and put my head between my legs, and there might have been some nausea with that, and I think I went back home and laid down for the rest of the afternoon. And then, since then, in the last 6 years, I lost a brother to a stroke and a heart attack, and about 2 weeks after that, I was at a cocktail party standing for several hours. It was a celebration, and I think I was dehydrated. I think I probably had a glass of red wine, probably was eating greasy cocktail nuts and food, and I felt extremely nauseous and felt I had to defecate, and I dropped to the floor and was taken to the ER and was observed all night, and the doctor released me the next morning, saying it was a vagovasal reaction, syncope, but check in with my MD. And then a few years later, I had a situation where I was having a very minor surgical operation being done on me. I didn't think I was stressed. Again, I had a I fainted, and I was caught. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sorry, Marion. We're running up against a break. I think we got your stories. Marion's now piecing together, I guess, some of what you explained. Dr. Borkum.
Yes, I would add, and of course, obviously, we don't want to diagnose or treat over the air. But I would add that migraines are very common in the general population. Mm-hmm. In fact, in any given year, 12% of the world's population qualifies for a diagnosis of migraine, meaning they've had at least 5 attacks or 2 attacks without aura.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to take a quick break. Again, the number 1-800-399-3566. A word about tomorrow's show. Join host Jennifer Rooks for a conversation with physicist and author Alan Lightman about his new book, Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet us or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com. On the next Speaking in Maine, a roundtable discussion at the University of Southern Maine.
There are a lot of people in the country that don't care about it or that are
skeptical. And it's not because we're tree huggers. Our mission is to defend the United States.
The withdrawal from the Paris Agreement was a grave mistake.
Senator Angus King joins Roger Sorkin with the American Resilience Project and retired Lieutenant General John Castelaw to discuss climate change and national security. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine this afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio. Over the past 5 years, the number of children living in poverty in Maine's rural Oxford County has risen to more than 25%. That's left more students and families homeless, without heat, or living month to month in small hotel rooms. Later today on Maine Things Considered at 5:30, we'll hear about a strategy from one rural school to help those families by sending staff out of the classroom and into students' homes. That's coming up later today on Maine Things Considered at 5:30 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Understanding Migraine Headaches. My guests are three medical professionals who've worked with migraine sufferers. Daniel Schwartz is a neurologist with Maine General, Jonathan Borkum, a psychologist with the University of Maine, and David Branch is a surgeon with Bangor Plastic and Hand Surgery. Join the conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Paul in Lincolnville. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a man in my mid-50s. When I was very young, I had severe migraines. And occasionally, I'll still get the aura, but I'm able to just close my eyes and breathe deeply and rub my temples, and the aura will go before a headache strikes. But my question, my grandmother and my aunt both suffered from severe migraines and died as a result of strokes. I'm wondering if there's any correlation between migraine headaches and their causes and possible strokes later in life. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Any connection?
So that has been studied in large population studies. The connection is very faint, and it specifically is with migraine with visual aura. But it's a very faint connection. You need to study 10,000 people to find a handful who have increased who have a stroke because of the history of migraine with aura, who would not have had a stroke otherwise. And that's specifically for stroke in younger people, not for people over the age of 60 or 65.
Chrissy via Facebook says, very occasionally, maybe twice a year, I get what I have been told is an ocular migraine. I lose some of my peripheral vision and get bright white spots on the focus points of my vision. This is followed by a searing headache that lasts for hours. Oddly enough, yesterday when I heard about this show, I started thinking about my own migraines and then promptly got one. This leads me to wonder if they can be brought on psychologically. First, what is this thing called an ocular migraine?
So this is Dr. Schwartz. An ocular migraine, I think, is just another term for a migraine with visual aura. I think there's some physicians out there who think they're different things, but in my mind, they're the same. And as far as the second question, which was can one think about a migraine and then bring it on, I think that's possible, but not common.
Dr. Branch, I think that if the migraine or the fear of migraine causes stress, causes you to think about it, tense your muscles, clench your teeth possibly, but more likely if it's an ocular migraine, frown, then or drive up your blood pressure and, you know, cause an artery to pound yet a bit harder next to the nerve. All of those sorts of things can trigger a migraine, and then the depolarization centrally occurs. So it makes perfect sense to me. I definitely feel like, I have to counsel patients against catastrophizing. If they postoperatively, if they go 3 months or 4 months without a headache and they get a headache, I have to talk them out of some patients anyway, out of becoming so stressed and fearful that they, possibly could do that. So that doesn't surprise me.
All right, let's go to Lawrence in Portland. Hi, Lawrence. Welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I suffer from chronic headaches significantly, very painful. I don't really categorize them as migraines, but 3-4 a week. And currently, I've tried dozens of different types of therapies, lots of different kind of drugs. Rizatriptans have probably been my most effective mode. I'm currently considering ketamine therapy, which is fairly new, and there's someone in the state who does that, and I'm calling to find out if you have an opinion about the efficacy of ketamine therapy.
Any thoughts, Dr. Schwartz?
So the theory behind ketamine is that it works on a chemical called NMDA, also glutamate. And the role for glutamate in the genesis of migraines, I think, still has to be fully uncovered. I'm not sure we fully understand yet its role in migraines. That said, there have been some studies that have shown some benefit with ketamine. It's certainly not my treatment of choice. I will try other things first. But there have been case reports or anecdotal evidence of it working.
Are there natural treatments for migraine? I mean, I've read about things in preparing for this show about, you know, ginger and peppermint oil and magnesium. But have any of these sort of been tested, and what can we say about them?
Oh, absolutely. This is Dr. Borkum. So there was a joint working group between the American Academy of Neurology and the American Headache Society, and they sorted through the evidence for preventive treatments of migraine. and categorized the various options into level of evidence for them. And they found there was good evidence for migraine preventive effects of magnesium, butterbur extract, feverfew, and riboflavin. And there also have been a few studies suggesting benefit for menstrual migraine, menstrually related migraine, from vitamin E, started a couple of days before menstruation and continuing until a couple of days afterwards. Ginger has only had a couple of studies. They have been very supportive, both as acute treatment and as a preventive.
All right, let's go to, let's see, we'll go to Roy on Mount Desert Island. Roy, welcome to the show.
Hello, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, about 9 weeks ago, I fell on the ice and got a concussion, and I'm still having a lot of issues about being fuzzy, and then I get a headache, and that kind of goes on for quite a while. I'm seeing a neurologist, chiropractor, and he's trying to get my dry rows back together here, but I'm still struggling. That's where I'm at.
Okay. Yes.
This is Dr. Branch. I think that there are a lot of patients that develop migraines who don't have family histories and perhaps weren't genetically predisposed to having migraines, who have their headaches brought on by a trauma, oftentimes the back of the neck, the head itself, or a fractured nose. So I've seen a number of patients that have that can temporarily relate the beginning of their headaches to some sort of incident. You know, I would reassure you to some degree that the healing process after, say, a large bruise around a nerve or a stretched muscle, torn muscle around a nerve, does take some time. You know, the healing process generally is about a full year for any kind of significant insult like that. But we are there has been a study done by Dr. Dusick in Georgetown looking at people that have had head injuries and did find that addressing them either with Botox or with surgery to eliminate the headaches at that 30-50% rate that we see with non-traumatic types of migraines. And I think that as we move forward in neurology and surgery and other related professionals or begin to work together, we'll be able to hopefully identify which head injury patient would benefit from an early intervention with, say, Botox or maybe even just a steroid injection, and which ones might benefit from just waiting and which ones actually might need surgery. So,
yeah, let's go to Barry in Scarborough. Hi, Barry. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, please.
All right. Great. So, you know, I'm a lifetime migraine sufferer. Started when I was 14, classic migraines, you know, scintillating scotoma and headache. About 9 years ago, I had a small stroke, and the workup subsequently showed that I had a patent foramen ovale, a PFO, which is a congenital heart defect. I had that repaired, had a septal occlusion device put in. And lo and behold, after I had it repaired, my migraine headaches totally disappeared. I'm going from a fairly frequent one or more a month to none since then. And I subsequently read that in fact, that's not unheard of or that's not uncommon. My question to the doctors is, do you ever, with patients that have severe migraines, do you ever look into whether they have a PFO? And if they do, is there ever a recommendation to consider repairing it?
Barry, you can't see them, but there are a lot of nodding heads in the studio as you were describing your situation. But who would like to tackle his question? Dr. Borkum?
The observation about the PFO is very well taken, and it's part of the data that makes us think that in certain cases, visual aura with migraine is the brain's natural defense against microembolisms or very small, very temporary occlusions in the blood supply. There's no question that statistically, patent foramen ovale is associated with migraine with visual aura, and in fact is 2 to 3 times more common in people who have migraine with visual aura. It turns out that a patent foramen ovale is actually fairly common in people who don't have migraines. and people with migraines without aura. So it's actually not as rare as you would think. As far as I know, the data on closing a PFO in order to treat migraines has been fairly weak. It sounds like you had an excellent outcome, which is wonderful. I think when you study it across large groups of people, the outcomes tend not to be very positive. And mostly where you see closures of PFO is if it's large enough that there's a risk of stroke, or people who are professional divers who need to have it closed so they don't get decompression symptoms when they come back up to the surface.
Let's go to Bill in Augusta. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I don't know if you're going to get background noise here or not. I think I'm far enough away that you won't.
Okay.
I've had migraines early in my adult life. I'm 83 years old now. And then they started up again at somewhere in the early 80s. And I have been a long-distance runner for most of my life. And during that period of time, I didn't experience the migraines. However, I have many triggers for migraines. And one of them is toxic chemicals, high fat, stress, and exertion. And I've seen many doctors and without success as far as, I should say limited success as far as to the medication that was taken. And I'm just wondering if there is someone else that I should confer with regarding the problem.
Okay, Bill, thanks. And we have about 30 seconds left. Any thoughts?
Have you seen anyone who's trained to inject Botox?
I've never talked to anyone about that. However, I've been told that it's very expensive.
Insurance will cover that. Just so you know, Medicare will cover that.
All right. And with that, we're out of time. Appreciate all the advice such that you can give it in this forum to people and answering questions and educating us about migraines. Thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Jonathan Borkum, a licensed psychologist who treats pain and headaches, and he's a faculty associate at the University of Maine. Dr. David Branch is a plastic surgery specialist at Bangor Plastic and Hand Surgery. He treats migraine patients. Dr. Daniel Schwartz is a neurologist in Augusta. He's with Maine General and specializes in headache medicine. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. We had additional help from George Thomas and Rich Tozier. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.